This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the High Yield Cash Account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A High Yield Cash Account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Oh, if only it was as easy as supply and demand. Oil and the politics of it in a global economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 23rd day of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We direct your attention today as just one relevant example to the Maryland Code of Business Regulation, Section 10-315, Paragraph A, quote, "A person who sells motor fuel at retail shall display signs in accordance with this section." So, of course, you read on, and then farther down, you see paragraph E, subpara 3, again quoting, "All numerals on the sign shall be at least 8 inches high and 3.5 inches wide and have a brush stroke of at least 1 inch." And this week, those 8x3.5 signs are showing on a national average $3.40 for a gallon of regular gas. Hence, with gas prices staring Americans in the face every day, the announcement from the White House this morning that it's going to release 50 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in the hopes, as the president said today from the podium, that that'll lower prices, which will then make their way to your corner gas station. Now, 50 million barrels of anything sounds like a lot. But we use a little bit more than 18 million barrels of petroleum every single day in this economy. So that's, what, just shy of like 3 days worth coming to market sometime soon-ish? Marketplace's Andy Euler gets to the bottom of the barrel.
When we hear about inflation, one of the first things that comes up is how much more it costs to fill up your car. That's put President Biden in the hot seat.
Gasoline prices happen to have this unique political connotation, and it also happened to be something that sometimes you can actually do something about.
That's Ellen R. Wald. She's president of Transversal Consulting. She says, unfortunately for consumers,
the coordinated release from the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve will probably have more of a political impact than it will a market impact.
That's because in the U.S., oil production and refining it into gasoline is up to private companies.
Oil prices are now in the hands of producers.
Clark Williams Derry at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis says before the shale boom, the government could blame OPEC and Russia for high oil prices. But now the U.S. is a top oil producer and investors want returns from oil companies.
Their incentives are all aligned to keep prices high. And that is going to create some real pain for consumers.
The U.S. isn't alone here. Five other countries are also releasing some oil. Now, historically, this happens because of a natural disaster, say a hurricane or political upheaval in an oil-producing country. Antoine Hauf at Columbia's Center on Global Energy Policy says this one's different.
There's no disruption. There's no hurricane, Katrina or other. There's no civil war. It's more a question of producer country supply management.
In other words, members of OPEC and the big oil companies in the U.S. aren't ramping up supply quickly enough to meet demand. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
One hates to be that guy, but I'm going to be that guy right now because crude prices today up. U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate up 2.5% at the close in New York, even with the news of the day. Priced in is the phrase you're looking for. Oil traders pretty much knew this SPR release was a-coming. Stock traders, on the other hand, of two minds, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. After turkey and football and I guess whatever family messiness happens in your house, what else is there to do this Thanksgiving weekend? Well, there's always the mall, if it still exists, obviously. If your mall survived the pandemic, it might look a little more bougie than it did in the before times. Think Burberry's and Cartier more than JCPenney and hot dogs on a stick. Marketplace's Matt Levin has more now on the very K-shaped mall recovery.
The 5.5 million square foot Mall of America near Minneapolis felt more like a retail mausoleum for much of 2020, which is why Executive Vice President Jill Renslow is very eager to share what's new.
We have a new 25,000 square foot attraction that has go-karting and axe throwing and amazing pizza.
If you have too much tryptophan in your system for the axe throwing, you can always do some shopping, although some stores will have longer lines than others.
Chanel, Gucci, Prada, which do phenomenal in this marketplace.
You'll still find GameStops and Gaps at Mall of America, but the bread and butter of many malls is looking more like Caviar and Bellini's these days.
During the pandemic, there was a huge demand for luxury goods.
Venky Shankar is a marketing professor at Texas A&M. He says rich people didn't spend money on vacations in 2020, but they would run out to the mall for a handbag.
And so the luxury retailers had more opportunities to sell, and so they become a safer bet for mall.
Matt Quint at Columbia University says malls in higher income areas are still struggling to find anchor stores, but they're making do. And for malls in less wealthy neighborhoods, some can be turned into housing or mixed-use developments, but
the reality is many of them will be ghost malls, and there will not be an appetite for quite some time to convert it into anything.
Can't bring the kids to a ghost mall this weekend. Maybe you can see if an Amazon warehouse will let them play with the forklift. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Okay, to recap where we are in our long national supply chain nightmare. There are 85 container ships anchored out waiting to dock at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach as I speak. We've been keeping track of those containers for our series Temporarily Unavailable, How Stuff Moves Around the World, or Doesn't. And we've talked about containers a lot because 90% of global trade goes by sea. So today, yes, because I'm a history guy, but also because it's important, a little backstory on how shipping containers came to be all that with a couple of people who are in pretty much the same position you and I are right now.
We ordered furniture last spring, and it took several months to arrive.
That's Joseph Bonney. He covered shipping as a journalist for years.
Well, we're actually trying to buy a car right now, and it is very hard to get a new car.
That's Teresa Fort. She's an associate professor at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth.
Yesterday, a sofa was delivered to my apartment. It took more than 9 months for the sofa to arrive.
And that is Mark Levinson. He's an economist, a historian, also the author of Outside the Box, How Globalization Changed from Moving Stuff to Spreading Ideas. The other name you need to know is Malcolm McLean, who 70 or so years ago was a truck driver by trade, also a businessman, and he'd built one of the biggest American trucking companies of its time.
And he was increasingly concerned in the first half of the 1950s that traffic congestion was delaying his trucks.
So he sells his trucking company and buys the Pan Atlantic Steamship Company out of Mobile, Alabama.
The reason for this is that shipping, like other modes of transportation, was quite heavily regulated. One couldn't simply start a ship line. So he bought one that already had the right to sail up and down the East Coast and the Gulf Coast of the United States.
For a while, McLean thought about just loading and unloading trucks themselves from those ships. And then he had a better idea.
Malcolm McLean had bought this vessel for very little money and had installed a false deck on the top of the tanker on which the containers could be placed. The first modern container ship voyage was on April 26, 1956. It involved a tanker ship left over from World War II called the Ideal X.
The SS Ideal X carried 58 containers from Newark down to Houston. Here's Joseph Bonney.
That is generally considered to be the start of the modern era of containerized shipping.
But just a start, because there were, of course, a lot of details to work out.
If you can imagine spending a decade in smoke-filled hotel conference rooms discussing how thick the end wall of a container should be, that's what went on here. The participants in these negotiations were overwhelmingly engineers. Some of them worked for ship lines, some of them worked for railroads, some of them were involved in the trucking industry, some were involved in the manufacturing of containers, and each of these parties had its own separate interests.
Standardization, the key to scaling the container economy, eventually came. Containers are now 8 feet wide and either 20 or 40 feet long. Again, Teresa Fort.
Shipping containers revolutionized how trade occurs and made trade costs much, much lower for many goods, made it a lot easier to get lots of different products onto ships, get them off the ships more quickly, load them directly onto trucks and trains, and then distribute them across the country. And so, you know, all of that then allows businesses to become more competitive, to have lower prices, to have more higher quality, more sophisticated products that they can bring to market.
Which gets us to...
The container was really key to what we now think of as globalization.
A box. A really big box that you put stuff in. Simple, but genius.
It's been interesting. This current supply chain crisis has made many people aware for the first time that of the role that container shipping plays in our daily lives. And it's a large essential industry that was hiding in plain sight for a lot of people.
And now you know. Teresa Fort at Dartmouth, retired journalist Joseph Bonney, and historian and economist Mark Levinson helped us out there. Coming up.
We're just kind of playing it a little safe, I'd say.
Better safe than sorry, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 194 today, about a half percent, 35,813. The NASDAQ went the other way, down 79 points, half percent there as well, 15,775. S&P 500 up 7, almost 0.2%, 46.90. $17 billion, that's how much Samsung reportedly plans to spend on a new semiconductor chip factory in Taylor, Texas, just outside of Austin. On the Korean exchange, shares in Samsung added about a half percent. As we mentioned at the top of Andy Euler's piece, average price of a gallon of regular gas nationwide right now, $3.40 a gallon, up more than a half percent over the past month, 61% higher than a year ago. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note, 1.67%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Zoom reported profits after the close yesterday. Made some money last quarter, the company did, even with some businesses doing more in-person work than not. But according to the digital intelligence company SimilarWeb, Zoom is losing small business clients and individual customers faster than it is gaining bigger corporate accounts. Still, some entrepreneurs have actually bet on video conferencing, including two small business owners in an industry you might not really expect to see online, as Marketplace's Caroline Champlin explains.
Shauna Race was a bartender in Los Angeles who would sometimes hold in-person cocktail classes. During lockdown, she lost those and her bar job.
And I sat with my head in my pillow for about a week, and then I pivoted my cocktail classes online.
Her business, called Talktails, has corporate clients, Better Mortgage, TrueCar, even Amazon, that buy her classes to recreate the after-work happy hour on Zoom.
All right, let's do our Angostura bitters. We're going to do four dashes. And a dash looks like this. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Ray says companies that were looking to boost morale came to her.
They were scrambling, and so they were looking for a way to bring spirits back.
Ahead of everyone returning to the office, Race plans to pivot to retail, selling cocktail kits. Because Zoom fatigue is a business risk, if you ask the guy that coined the term, Stanford communication professor Jeremy Bailenson.
You can be physically fatigued. You can be socially fatigued. You don't want to see someone. You can be overall fatigued. And it's important to differentiate because there's different solutions to each one.
For people looking to connect long distances, Bailenson expects Zoom to stick around. That's what Sarah Mangoni is hoping too. She's the owner of Historically Drinking, another online cocktail business with classes and videos about the backstory of different drinks.
Even as people are being like released out into the world again, you can hang out with your friends and family from all over the country and all over the world doing this, which is great.
Mangoni still has a job at a bar, but this week she's holding her first online event after a hiatus and is hoping her audience will still be there. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
While the United States is gradually lifting some of its cross-border travel restrictions, north and south, there has been real economic damage done to communities along those borders the past year and a half. And one of the hardest hit is Boquillas del Carmen. It's a tiny Mexican town just across the Rio Grande from Big Bend National Park. The small border crossing connecting Boquillas to the park was shut down completely, cutting that community off from the tourist who sustained it. So, as Marfa Public Radio's Annie Rosenthal reports, residents got creative to make ends meet.
It's a sunny afternoon in Big Bend National Park, and the water of the Rio Grande is shallow and warm. Veronica Ureste is riding a horse into the middle of the river, which marks the international border here.
Hello.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Ureste lives in Boquillas del Carmen, a community of about 250 people on the Mexican side. With her, she's brought a bag of the crafts her town is known for, aprons and purses embroidered with the flora and fauna of the borderlands.
ocotillos, roadrunners, donkeys. That's what we sell.
The watery rendezvous is a little inconvenient, but for much of the past 2 years, it was the only way Ureste could meet with Americans. Boquillas is usually connected to Big Bend by a small port of entry, staffed by park employees and monitored remotely by customs officers who check your passport via video call. But in March 2020, the crossing shut down, a pandemic measure meant to protect both the rural village and visitors to the park. At other ports, U.S. citizens and essential workers were still allowed to go back and forth. Here, though, Big Bend National Park Superintendent Bob Kremenacker explains that wasn't the case.
Boquillas is probably the first to close and the last to open of all the ports because from an economic point of view on a global basis, there's not much going on.
But for people like Ureste, the crossing is vital. Pre-pandemic, Boquillas played host to thousands of visitors a year, tourists from the national park who would cross in a rowboat and ride a donkey up to the village for a taste of rural Mexican life. So when the port closed, Ureste and her neighbors found themselves cut off from their financial lifeline and necessities in the U.S. Boquillas is 4 hours from the nearest grocery store on the Mexican side.
And we are like a community like so far away from the other cities, and right now it's hard.
People in town had to adapt to get by. Some men crossed the river discreetly, putting crafts on the American side with coffee cans where tourists could leave payment. Other residents, like Ureste, moved their businesses online when the pandemic started, to platforms like Facebook.
First, I was, like, very scared. I barely used Facebook, and I didn't know how to do it. Even how to post, I was scared.
Now, Ureste has built up a clientele around Texas. Her father lives in the U.S. and regularly made the trip down through the nearest open port of entry, hours away, to pick up the wares in Boquillas. Then he brought them back for buyers as far away as San Antonio and Dallas. Neighbors near the river also pitched in to help. People like Mike Davidson, who runs the Boquillas International Ferry, the rowboat that takes people across the river in normal times.
We raised about $20,000 that went towards emergency supplies and food, and I mean diapers, baby food, everything that they needed.
The U.S. government quietly lent a hand, too. Ureste says Americans in uniform beckoned Boquillas residents to the river's bank to be vaccinated. This spirit of help is what made these long 20 months bearable, Ureste says. Despite the challenges of living in Boquillas, she adds, almost no one moved away. And she plans to stick around.
I love my town. I love to live here. I have gone out and live in big cities, and I don't like it. I love it here.
Now she's eager to welcome visitors back to Boquillas. Not online or from the river, but on dry land. In Big Bend National Park, I'm Annie Rosenthal for Marketplace.
We mentioned last week, I think it was, that Netflix has decided it is, in fact, going to brag about its streaming numbers after years and years of not. According to the latest global data out today, people have spent more than 129 million hours watching Red Notice, including me, last night. 2 hours that I'm never going to get back. But big screens are drawing eyeballs as well. Stephanie Silverman is one of the people we've been following for our series on the American labor force, the United States of Work, we call it. She's the executive director of a nonprofit movie theater in Nashville called The Bell Court, and we got her on the phone the other day.
You know, things are going okay. I would still rate them a solid okay, which I feel like is what I've been rating them for a little while now, but you know.
Let's do the scale of okay here, right? Is this okay we're getting by, or it's okay better than it used to be?
I'd say okay it's getting better.
Okay.
You know, we're seeing the numbers trend in the way we want them to in terms of people coming back and ticket sales and films being released. Like all of those things are lining up in a much more normal looking way. It's just still slower than it used to be.
Talk to me about films and movies being released. Do you have enough fodder, I suppose, to get people in the seats?
Yeah, you know, it really is beginning to look, and dare I say it, a little normal on the releasing front, at least for us. So I don't think we're going to go backwards from here.
Well, that's good. That's good. Are you still limiting capacity? I mean, you know, could you sell it out if you wanted to, but you're being cautious?
We could. We are still limiting capacity to 50%. We could sometimes sell it out. But, you know, we show films several times a day. So it's not like in a performing arts center where they have one show a day. We can give people a little breathing room without cutting into our financials in the same way you would if you were a Broadway house, right? So we're just kind of playing it a little safe, I'd say.
Yeah. Speaking of cutting into your financials, let me ask you, small business person, how inflation is rearing its ugly head at the Belcourt, or is it?
You know, it's not too bad in terms of the film world.
Yeah.
But certainly in our concessions areas, we are seeing it. You know, there are some weeks where a kind of glass that we used to always order is all of a sudden not available and we have to get something else. Huh. You know, we're seeing prices for the regular kinds of popcorn candy begin to trend a little up. So it's really in the concessions world that we feel that pinch.
Are you paying people more? Are you having to get them to come and work in the concessions and ticket booth and all that?
Yeah, we've raised our hourly rates by a couple bucks since we reopened in April. It was always a goal of ours. And in some ways, this pandemic has forced all of us to begin to work towards something that's really more appropriate and equitable and sustainable for people working hourly wages. We're still not where we should be. And I think this is a real challenge for small businesses because our city is doing great. People are moving here. So the tax base is growing, but that means cost of living is going up. Housing stock is hard to find. And hourly wages, at least as required by our city or our state, have not changed. I mean, they're still at that low, low federal rate. So we just haven't kept up as a business community, and now we're paying the price for it. And I think this is happening all over the place, honestly.
Yeah, no, it is. So it's just to sort of summarize here, you sound reasonably optimistic. And look, I mean, my impression of you, we've never met face to face, but my impression of you is that you are an upbeat kind of person. But this is an optimism I'm not sure I've heard.
Yeah, it finally feels like we might walk into 2022 and see some consistency that has not been present to date. Huh. October looked a little normal, and then November looked a little more normal, and December is looking pretty darn normal. So of course we're nervous about the holidays, but I'm just hoping that we have enough safeguards in place that maybe we can hold a spike at bay and enter 2022 with some of this momentum that we're finally beginning to feel.
Stephanie Silverman, she runs the Belcourt Theater there in Nashville. Stephanie, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, really good to talk to you too, Kai. Thank you.
You bet. This final note on the way out today, in which Dollar and a Quarter Tree just does not roll trippingly off the tongue, I guess. Dollar Tree announced today it's going to raise prices on most of the stuff it sells from $1 to $1.25. Of note, though, was this line from its announcement in its earnings statement this morning. The price increase, the company said, is not a reaction to short-term or transitory market conditions. That's good, because if it was all about inflation, it'd have to be $1.062 tree. See what I did there? Inflation's at 6.2%. You get it? All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. It's a number today, and that number is 5. It's how many days in a row the TSA has screened more than 2 million people. If you are flying the next couple of days, so look, get there early, wear a mask, be kind, and please know that those of us who are not traveling really appreciate the effort you're making. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.